I've actually been interested in questions like what makes us different from chimpanzees, for example, for a long time. That's partially a personal story. My parents are missionaries in Gabon in Central Africa. They are biologists who also worked in missions at the same time. And my father, being a biologist, liked to collect animals, and so I grew up with a chimpanzee. And just in case you can't tell the difference, this is the chimpanzee and that's me. My mother says that we looked different, but we behaved remarkably similarly. And so one of the questions is, what makes us different, right? And so, as you know, we share 15% of our genes with E. coli, 25% with yeast, 70% with frogs. If you kiss a frog and it becomes a chimp. If you kiss a frog and it becomes a prince, then you might share even more than 70%. And something like 98% of chimps, depending a little bit on how you count. So one of the really interesting questions is, what makes us different? Why are we different? Because clearly, hopefully at least to you, it's clear that we are somewhat different. And of course, one of the reasons why we're different is because this picture, this idea of genes being a kind of a blueprint, like an architectural drawing, is a very old-fashioned and outmoded idea. And instead, what we really should think about genes as interacting networks. And so here I have a picture, which I'll look for you. This is actually from Uri Alon's book on systems biology, which I teach. I teach a course on systems biology in Oxford, and I use this textbook. It's usually one of the first slides I show my students. And I point out that each of those lines is a locus of control from one protein to the other one. So this right here, CRP, is part of lactose digestion, basically. And so each of those lines is doing something, is turning the gene on and off. Many genes are switches, right? And so just as in a transistor, you can make many different types of things. You can make oscillators, you can make switches, you can make all kinds of things by just rearranging the wiring. In the same way, in our genes and our genomes, a lot of different phenotypes can be created by simply rewiring things and changing things around. And so that's, of course, very interesting for a physicist or somebody with a physicist background, because you can model these things with differential equations. And there's all kinds of interesting questions about, is there emergent behavior that comes out of these things? Do these networks show particular kinds of emergent behavior? And I think that there are. And I've been studying the evolution of these, for example, and there are all kinds of really fascinating questions about evolution. That's one of the kind of things that I've been interested in. I think it's one of the really interesting cutting-edge new ways of thinking about biology, really biology at this more emergent level. The second thing I've been working on is biological assembly. There you just saw a bacterium. This is a video which you may have seen. This is a video from Keiji Namba's group in Osaka. It's an animation of the assembly of the bacterial flagellar motor. So the bacterial flagellar motor is this amazing little piece of nanomachinery. It can spin up to 100,000 RPM. It can stop in essentially a quarter of a turn. And I'm actually working with a colleague of mine on the assembly of these two rings on the bottom. And we're trying to understand some of the properties of the assemblies of this thing. But it's an absolutely amazing little piece of nanomachinery. If I were to come into this room with a life-size version of this machine, you would say, well, it was made somewhere in a factory. Some complicated thing came together and they put all those things in. But what happens in the cell is that these little machines, just these proteins float around, and almost by magic, they pop right into the right positions. And if you think about the many, many different ways that normally this could misfold or misbond, it does seem almost miraculous that something like this could form in real time. Now here's a thought for you. You actually have 10 times as many bacteria in your body as you have cells in your body, give or take. Which means that, and that's, before you rush off to the hospital, that's perfectly normal. You're part, humans are part microbe. There's a microbiome, and you share some microbes, and many of them are quite different. Microbes are a lot smaller because they are prokaryotic and not eukaryotic cells. You can understand that from basic physics, in fact. It's a little problem set I give to my students. So while I'm speaking to you today, this process that you just observed will be happening millions of times in your body. It takes roughly the life cycle of a cell, say for E. coli in the good conditions, 20 minutes for one of these things to form. So one of the things I've been interested in, actually ever since I saw this movie, is, well, how does this work? What is the physics of self-assembly? What's the mathematics of self-assembly? What's the biology of self-assembly? If we can understand it, then we could perhaps emulate it and make things at a nanostructure, a nanoscale. Things at a nanoscale can't be made by direct manipulation. They have to be made by self-assembly. And in fact, one of probably half of my research group works essentially on trying to understand self-assembling things. And I think we've made a lot, and I showed you a little bit about viruses. I also work a lot on DNA self-assembly, a whole series of things of that nature. So that's the kind of thing that I'm interested in scientifically. So these questions about gene networks, questions about self-assembly. And I'm interested both in the real-time self-assembly, well, how does something self-assemble? What's the design principles you need to self-assemble something? And I'm interested in the evolution of self-assembling systems. So how do you evolve systems that can self-assemble? And those are problems that are fascinating for theorists, because there are all kinds of interesting properties of high-dimensional spaces that you can exploit and think about. But what we're really thinking about today is this question that we discussed yesterday as well, this question of the history of life on Earth. So here's the kind of standard picture. You know, the Earth formed from an accretion disk 4.5 billion years ago, roughly. The first roughly billion years, there was what we call the late heavy bombardment, when stuff was still floating around like crazy and bashing against the Earth. Not too long after that, and the slightly mysterious origin of life, and then basically microbes ruled the Earth for most of Earth's history. Then unicells and multicells, and then man. And so, an interesting thing is, if you were to make to get a feeling for the age of the Earth, if you were to take the Earth and put it down to a 24-hour period, then dinosaurs would have gone extinct 20 minutes before midnight. Animals wouldn't have appeared, like, actually to last 2 hours before midnight. Anatomically, modern humans, perhaps in the last 1 or 2 seconds, and your life history, recorded history, would be the last tenth of a second, and your life would be the last millisecond of that 24-hour day. So, you know, these are long periods of time. And so the kinds of questions that we're looking at today is really, how do we understand, or could we think a little bit about this change over time? And yesterday, I will repeat this again, we looked at these different versions of evolution, evolution of natural history, which is really something but geology, archaeology, that's really the main paleontology, the kind of fields that we look at for the idea that the Earth is old, astronomy, those are the things where this comes from. Then there's a question about evolution as mechanism. So the question about intelligent design is really one about evolution as a mechanism, and that's the thing that I'm going to be discussing today. And of course, we all agree that evolution as a big picture, as a worldview, is something that Christians should be focusing their apologetic order on, or their guns on. And of course, all the kinds of issues that we need to consider are complicated. There's interpretation of the Bible, question of interpretation of nature. But I'm not going to discuss those today. I'm really going to talk a little bit more about science. To talk about science, I want to introduce something completely unrelated to evolution, and you'll see in a minute why I'm doing this. So, in fact, I just think, yeah, I'll do it this way. I'll do it this way around. So, yes, I'll do it this way. So, I just realized I missed my slides around. So, before I jump into Paul Dirac, I'm going to tell you what I'll tell you, what I'm going to tell you, which is that I'm going to speak firstly about evolution and what I call tapestry arguments in science. It's a kind of a heuristic way of thinking about how we think about science. Then I'll think about evolution and metaphors, and then I'll talk about evolution and what we might call impossibility arguments. I will get back, you'll see that in a minute. I will explain it to you. So, tapestry is like a cloth. But I'll show you a picture and then it'll be clearer. So first of all, I want to say something. This is a classic story in mathematics, the kind of story that you're brought up with as a theoretical physicist. So, as you probably know, in 1926, Erwin Schrödinger came up with the Schrödinger equation, which describes the behavior of small particles like electrons. And so, of course, in 1905, Albert Einstein had already come up with special relativity, E is mc squared. And this is just the classic energy-momentum relationship, E is mc squared. So you see the square root of mc squared squared is just mc squared, right? And then there's the momentum thing there. And so there's an obvious question. What happens when you take something that's very small, governed by Schrödinger's equation, and you make it move very fast, so that it should transform according to the Lorentz transformations of special relativity? It's a pretty obvious and interesting question, and Paul Dirac, the great mathematical physicist in Cambridge, up in his little room in St. John's College, was pondering this. And it turns out that when you try to write down something like a Schrödinger equation, in a covariant form, so a form that follows relativity. So if you do it for an electron has spin up and spin down, right? So there's two components, spin up and spin down component. It turns out that the only way you can do that, the only way you can find an algebra that basically has the right anti-commutation or the right commutation relationships is by having four vectors. And so you have this very strange thing that the mathematical structure of the world seems to impose on us, not just one thing with spin up and spin down, but some other object with spin up and spin down. And Dirac's great genius was just to say, well, this is what the equations say, this must be it. And he wrote it down, the Dirac equation. And it was only a few years later that Carl Anderson and Caltech discovered the positron, the second one part of this little equation. And so that isn't, I remember as a student, an undergraduate, taking a quantum mechanics course where we started out with the Dirac equation and we did the derivation. I remember thinking, you know, there is no way that pure mathematical reasoning about two very disparate things, special relativity, which is relatively straightforward to understand, it's pretty simple, quantum mechanics, Schrodinger equation, a little bit more mysterious, but you can understand it pretty well. You take these two very disparate things, you put them together, and out pops, no matter how hard you try, something like a completely different type of matter, antimatter, something so great, strange, you wouldn't have thought of it in your wildest dreams. And I spent the whole night once trying to see where Dirac had missed something. And of course, that's the typical hubris of youth. You work all night and you realize that you have to bow to the great master. And this is what we call, in physics, the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, which is a gift which we neither understand nor deserve. There's been some interesting writing on it by Mark Steiner, a philosopher, and some other writers on the applicability of mathematics as a philosophical problem. John Polkinghorne has a nice recent book on the topic. And so Eugene Wigner, a famous physicist, wrote this essay on the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. And so that's interesting because what this story tells you is explains a little bit about how physicists like to think. So we believe in the power of mathematics to tell us something about the physical world, because this is an example which is, it's so amazing when you read it. You just think, well, there is absolutely, mathematics is unbelievably powerful. And there is something really amazing, absolutely extraordinary about our physical world, which is that we can use abstract mathematical reasoning and come to some truth about the way the world is, including truth about the way the world is that we would never have imagined otherwise. It allows us to peer much more deeply into the fabric of reality than it seems like we deserve. And for many Christians, this resonates with the idea of a God, an intelligence behind the world, a deep, powerful structure to the way that the world is. And this means also for those of us trained in the physical sciences, this is a very important part of our socialization. It's a big important part of how we tend to think about the world, how we tend to think science ought to be done in its purest form by our greatest heroes, like Paul Dirac. And we all would like to have our, you know, our own kind of epiphany and discover our own equation of this type. Dirac was a famous character and didn't speak very much. And Richard Feynman, another great physicist, who was a huge admirer of Dirac, story tells one day he was sitting next to him at dinner, and he said, you know, it must have been really exciting and amazing to have made that discovery and to discover this Dirac equation. And Dirac looked. Yes, he said. He kept eating. So this is the story. So now fast forward a few years, and here is a book that you may be interested in. It's called The Golem. It's a book by Harry Collin and Trevor Pinch, two of the founding, or two of the very important thinkers in the field of social studies, or science technology studies, which is a field of people that try to study how science works. And they wrote this book, The Golem, the first kind of textbook in that field with a bunch of case studies on the history of science and how science works. And the arguments are, one of the chapters was on special relativity. So those of you that, how many of you have done some special relativity in school or in university? A few of you get, so you probably remember the way it's often taught is, you know, in 1887, Michelson and Morley did an experiment, this ether experiment where they put these two light sources down, and then it went with or against the, or perpendicular to the way the Earth moved. And the question was, would there be an interference signal caused by the ether drift. And to their great amazement, they didn't find any ether drift. And so this was the great conundrum that had to be thought of. And then finally, 1905, Einstein cut the Gordian knot and said, light has the same speed in all reference frames. And that way, we solve this great mystery of the Michelson-Morin experiment. And so what these guys in the Golem point out is that in 1933, a man called Dayton Miller and a few others redid the Michelson-Morin experiment much more carefully, much more under much more controlled conditions, and they found an ether drift. Okay, so the claim was Michelson and Morley are wrong. And so, conclude Collins and Finch, the meaning of an experimental result does not then depend on the care with which it was designed and carried out. It depends on what people are ready to believe. And this seemed like a interesting, because why did the, you know, why, and because the scientific community completely ignored Miller, right? They just said whatever, you know, whatever. And so this is a, you know, maybe a classic example of, for those of the people that doubt evolution, to point out that there's this, you know, there's this community of scholars that have decided already in their head what's true, and so they ignore all evidence to the contrary. Because here was a much more careful experiment that was ignored. So this is a, I'll get to the story in the end, because actually there's a long history up until the 70s of people redoing these experiments, and they were incredibly subtle. And as many, you know, as many great experiments in history, the Michelson-Morin experiment was probably fiddled, just like Pasteur's experiments were probably fiddled. Many of the great experiments in history, often if you try to redo them, it's not always entirely clear where the great geniuses got the answers that they did. The Michelson-Morin may have been one of them. But David Merman, one of my teachers at Cornell, wrote a very interesting article in Physics Today on this particular question of the Michelson-Morin experiment and Dayton Miller. And he said, and he tried to explain why the community had ignored Miller. And he said basically following, science is like a tapestry, like a cloth, made of many things woven together. And when we say that we believe that special relativity is true, it's not just because there's one line there, which is the Michelson-Morin experiment. It's because Dirac used special relativity, combined it with quantum mechanics, predicted antimatter, and we found antimatter. Right? So it's because when you take special relativity and you calculate the fine structure of the hydrogen atom energy levels, you can explain the fine structure. You can explain a lot of things in basic quantum mechanics by special relativity. And so there are all of these tapestries we've woven together, including and so it's a very, very strong story. So by the time 1933 came along, after the positron had been discovered, there really was very little doubt in physicists' minds that special relativity was true. There had been so many different independent, completely unrelated things that just wove together this really, really strong tapestry. And so if you come, like Dayton Miller does, and says, one of those strings breaks if you pull on it, what most people think is, well, you know, those are hard experiments. They're actually quite subtle to do. Probably he got something wrong. Right? It's not because the community as a whole was blind to evidence and was bigoted. It was simply because there was this whole tapestry of evidence. And the difficulty, and what Merman pointed out, is you can pick at a few strings, but that doesn't break the whole cloth. And the difficulty is that what makes you a good physicist is your ability to look at an argument and to understand exactly how well those things weave together, how strongly that whole pattern is, and whether pulling one string actually does anything significant to the whole pattern. Now, sometimes you pull a string, the whole thing unravels, but in this case, clearly it doesn't. It also is why it's really hard for non-specialists like Collins and Pinch to read a textbook and think that they understand the reasons that a community has to hold to particular types of arguments. And that was the point that Merman was making, basically that they had completely misunderstood the reasons why the physics community took this thing so seriously. So that is just each of your fields, those of you as scientists will recognize that, you know, people sometimes a little bit on the fringes come in and occasionally will say things about your field, which you think, yeah, but what about this? What about that? What about that? What about that? There's a lot of things that you need to learn. As a physicist moving into biology the last decade, I've been chastened a little bit with my belief in the power of theoretical methods. And here I quoted this yesterday. This is Evelyn Fox Keller, who was a physicist, who moved into biology and then is now a philosopher, a very interesting thinker. She did a lot of important work on Turing patterns, for example. And she talks about this, the first time she, as a physicist, in the 1960s, I think, or 1950s, was teaching a class to some biology students. And she taught them, basically, looking at dimensional analysis, right, which is a classic thing you teach in basic engineering. You know, you've got length and a time, and you have a speed, and you can link these things together. It tells you how many independent variables there are. And so at the end, one of the students raises his hand and says to her, "Excuse me, ma'am, how do you know that's true, dimensional analysis? Have you done the experiment?" And she was completely flabbergasted by this, didn't know what to say, because how could dimensional analysis not be true? I mean, of course it's true, right? And those of you that are physical scientists will look at me like, why would you possibly want to do an experiment to show dimensional analysis is true? Of course it's true. But the point is that she said that she, and this is what she writes about in this really lovely, very fascinating book, Making Sense of Life. "To them, the biologists, experimental evidence, fallible as it might be, provided a far surer avenue to truth than did mathematical reasoning. Their implicit assumption seemed to be, how could one know one's assumptions were correct? Where, in a purely deductive argument, was there room for the surprises that nature might offer, for mechanisms that might depart altogether from those imagined in our initial assumptions? Indeed, for some biologists, the gap between empirical and logical necessity looms so large as to make the latter seem effectively irrelevant." And about maybe in 2004, I organized a conference in Cambridge with some colleagues on physics, mathematics, and biology. And it was going as well with biologists, physicists, mathematicians together. We were talking about protein interactions. And at one point, Janet Thornton, a very famous bioinformatician, was giving a talk on protein ternary structure, protein clusters. And so what you see is that you see a lot of dimers, trimers, tetramers, but not that many pentamers, and then lots of hexamers. And so I asked the question, why are there so few pentamers? By which I meant something quite innocent. And one of the other, actually the final speaker, who I won't name, is a very famous biologist, jumps up and his face is completely red. He begins screaming at me, "You can't say that! You can't say that! You can't ask why questions of biology! You can't! You can't!" So we all stopped. So afterwards, I asked them, you know, wait, he says, "Yeah, you just, biology is not like that. Biology, all you can do is say how questions. You can say how something worked, but you can't say why. You can't do this." And what was grating on him was this kind of the idea that we could do these theoretical arguments about how nature ought to be, and that this would have some kind of traction on biological truth. His argument was you had to do the experiment, and unless you did the experiment, who knows? And that is maybe one extreme in the spectrum, but I've learned that, you know, if I go and give my biology colleagues a theoretical argument, a lot of them just roll their eyes and they say, "Well, you know, let's do the experiment and we'll see." So the other interesting thing is that when I, as a physicist, look at biological experiments and I see a line drawn through some pretty dots with a lot of big error bars on it, my instinct is to think, well, this is probably not serious. But in spite of the fact that my instinct is that way, there is no question that biology has moved forward dramatically over the last few decades. And so even though I worry about their epistemic style, there's no question that they are able to do this really well. So what makes someone a really good biologist is their ability to look at a lot of data, to look at experiments, to kind of analyze. They have this understanding of a tapestry argument, and they kind of can see how this might all fit together. In physics, we like our tapestries really tight and very mathematical. In biology, they like their tapestries a little bit more loose and very experimental. And what makes you a really good biologist is your ability to look at a lot of data, a lot of experiments, and to kind of see how to build the right tapestry. Which means that for me, as someone who works in biological physics, I need absolutely to work with good biologists because they're able to assess the strengths of experimental arguments a lot better than I do. So why am I going on about this? It's because even though basic scientific principles are shared across fields, what is considered necessary or sufficient for a self-organized tapestry varies from field to field and is often unwritten. This is what makes interdisciplinary work often so difficult. And you can see this when you try to do write grants or do peer review in interdisciplinary fields. People have very strong senses about how one ought to do things, cultural things. You know, and roughly in terms of purity, we start with mathematics, then we move to physics, then to chemistry, then to biology, then to medicine, psychology, sociology, at the very bottom of the heap, anthropology. And in spite of the fact that the methods in anthropology are significantly different than the methods in pure mathematics. The cultures are very different. It doesn't mean that anthropologists aren't making any progress at all. It just means that things are different. And sometimes the accuracy with which we're able to treat certain problems comes at the cost of imposing limits. So one of my colleagues will say, oh, that's just chemistry, by which they mean that's too complicated to treat properly mathematically, and so physicists, we're not going to worry about that. It doesn't mean that those are not interesting in chemistry or not interesting problems. It just means that the way chemists do things is slightly different, etc., etc., etc. So that's my kind of little spiel on tapestry arguments. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because I think when you look at the way biologists think about data, it's important to keep in mind that in the back of their mind is this kind of tapestry argument. So I'm going to skip this one. I'm going to look at this one. So here is a typical biologist story about why they might believe that evolution is true. So this is actually something I saw Francisco Ayala, a famous biologist, do once in a talk where he was trying to convince an audience about evolution is true. It's kind of a classic story of horse evolution. You look over time at fossils, you can see these remnants of these various fingers, essentially, and you now you just have the single hoof. And he tells a story, and then he says, you know, how could you not believe that this is true? Of course, all the physicists in the audience just roll their eyes. They think, well, that's just a story, right? There's just these things, right? Just a story. It doesn't tell you anything. Of course, what Ayala is not telling you is a whole bunch of other things that he has in the back of his mind in which this story is embedded. So for him, this seems like a very compelling story because in the back of his mind are a whole series of other things that weave together into a tapestry. But these are tapestries that are harder to understand by outsiders. Let me give you another tapestry argument for the kinds of things that that biologists think suggest that humans, for example, have common ancestry with other animals. So there's a protein called I can never pronounce it right, but vitellogenin, which is used in egg yolk formation in chickens. Gallo-gallo is called chicken, but in the vast majority of birds. Gallus-gallus. I see gallo-gallus from wine. So the kind of argument would be, well, you know, sometime in the past there was a common ancestral population and then it split and mammals would be like ourselves, would have split a long time ago. And so the question would then be, evolution might make some prediction that you might find something related or similar to this vitellogenin gene in other organisms. And of course, one of the things that we know is that often genes can be moved around, but typically they'll be related to each other. So in this particular case, in the chicken, there's a gene A, and then there's this gene B. So what we might do is look at other animals and look at gene A and look at gene B and look at what's in between there and see whether there's anything like that on that vitellogenin gene. Clearly, we no longer use that gene. We no longer have egg yolks, but it would be interesting to see if that's there. And so this is the paper. This gene is present inside of mammals. So we can look at this and see whether there's something, a remnant left of that. And in fact, when this was done in the paper that you see here and a number of other papers, that's exactly what was found. So here is the chicken genome. Here's the human genome, chimpanzee, orangutan, monkey, and a pig. And what you see is this very nice sequence. You see these very similar mutations that are different. You see these deletion points here. There's deletion. So where something's been chopped out. So this gene fragment no longer makes the protein that we use for egg yolks, which is probably a good thing, but there's still a lot of it left in the human genome. And there's many, many examples of this type. Now, even if this thing were to have some residual function, right, that doesn't necessarily mean that's perfectly possible. So just as if you sometimes go around, you see people use toilets as planters for plants. That does. If I see something like this, part of a toilet used as a planter, that I still know where that toilet came from, right? Originally, it's still interesting if I can reuse it in some way or the other. And so, I think it is interesting to ask yourself to think about whether these pseudogenes like this can be reused in some regulatory fashion or another. If you look at this thing and you look at all these different genes, you look at the way they mutations are the same, the deletions are the same. In this kind of tapestry argument, for most biologists, this seems like pretty strong evidence for some kind of common descent between humans and other animals. And we can go a bit further and ask ourselves, well, what about humans and chimpanzees, or humans and higher primates? So just purely by looking at fossils and looking at similarities, you can make a link, something like this. There are New World monkeys, older monkeys, gibbons, orangutans, gorillas. Somewhere about 5 billion years ago, chimpanzees split off, and then humans. And so when biologists say that we have common ancestors, it doesn't mean people say did we come from the apes. Well, no, we also came from the chickens, right? We came from the bacteria. We came from many things, right? There's some kind of common ancestry. And the question is, why do biologists think that is true? Well, one, they believe that to be true for a long time based on fossils and based on homologies. It seemed like a pretty strong argument. That's one set of strings that you put together. There are other arguments. This is actually a fairly old one on chromosomes. So humans have 23 chromosomes. Apes have one more chromosome, right? So here the chromosomes are lined up. This is a kind of a banding which stains depending on CGAT content. And so what you notice, first of all, is that the banding is quite similar. So here what I have is basically human, chimpanzee, gorilla, orangutan. Here you see the banding. And what you notice is that humans have one less chromosome, but if you take these two chromosomes from the chimpanzee, the gorilla, the orangutan, you line them up by banding, they're clearly very similar, except that there's two of them and there's one in us. And so the biological argument would be to say, well, we know that there are these things called chromosomal fusions. These occur. So presumably what happened in this case was a chromosomal fusion. Two of these, somewhere between the time when the chimpanzee split off and the time when the human came, there was a fusion between these chromosomes, and these two chromosomes fused into one. And that's why we have one less chromosome than chimpanzees. And the argument seems pretty compelling just looking at the banding. You say, well, yeah, that's the banding, and it could be the same. Now, you could say, well, what if God just created the human? And of course, God can create the human not too dissimilar from the chimpanzee. So we wouldn't be surprised if God reused some of the same machinery a second time, right? Why would God not do that? So God could have created de novo a human being with no common ancestry with chimpanzees, and we would still find God would use one less chromosome, but it would be quite similar. It could also be that God created human beings through the ordinary ways that God sustains the world, through the normal processes that he uses. And then we might ask ourselves, would that make a different prediction? Well, it would make a prediction. Basically, chromosomes have centromeres in the middle that are used when the cell splits, and there's telomeres at the end. And so if you took two of these things and put them together, you'd expect to find a remnant of a telomere and the remnant of a centromere in the inside. So now we have a falsifiable prediction. If it was made de novo, we would not expect to find telomere remnants. And if it was made by a process of this type, we expect there to be some kind of remnants. And so, in fact, a few years ago already, people looked for these remnants, and they found them at these particular points, from the 114,444,823rd to this one. There's a subtelomeric remnant, and there are some centromeric remnants. And so you can see that for a biologist, this would be what you would expect. You'd expect to see these remnants, and this suggests that there is some kind of common ancestry. This is something, one of many things that you weave together in your tapestry. And you might pick a little bit at this argument and say, well, they didn't quite do it right, maybe it's not this one or that. But it does seem to cohere. And there's a whole series of other arguments that I won't go into great detail. There are things like retroviruses, which insert bits of their virus DNA into our DNA. And you can line up the common descent from monkeys to humans by just looking at what does everybody have in common and what do they not have in common. And if you do that, you get exactly the same kind of curve. So these are viral insertions. And you can use other elements of this type as well that all suggest a kind of common ancestry. So for example, we share a gene that would make vitamin C with a lot of other animals, but we no longer make vitamin C, which is why we have to eat fruit. but that gene is still there in our bodies. It just has a few mutations in it that has turned it off and it's no longer active. And these are all the kinds of things. These are a whole series of things that you expect there to be. So for biologists, why do biologists think that the evidence for common descent with humans and animals is so overwhelming? It's because there's this many, many different strands, many different predictions that have all come together, and they weave together into pretty strong arguments. And if you look at one of those arguments and you say, oh, I can find a flaw in that argument, they'll say, fine, but look at this whole picture. It's so strong, a bit like the Michelson Morton experiment, it's going to be hard to overturn that kind of a paradigm. For those of us that work on biology, now, evolution arguments are used everywhere, and there was a period when evolution was a bit the E word. Molecular biology didn't really worry about it that much, but with modern genomics, it's used all the time for all kinds of inferences. It's an incredibly important part of a biologist's toolkit, and so it's becoming a much more important part of how we think about things. I know from experience of giving this talk that for some people this is incredibly troubling. I think this has to do with a series of theological issues. And rather than solve the theological issues, I'm just going to point out that we're not the first to think about this. So here's C.S. Lewis, I quoted him yesterday, when the author of Genesis says that God made man in his own image, he may have pictured a vaguely corporeal God making man as a child makes a figure out of plasticine. A modern Christian philosopher may think of the process lasting from the first creation of matter to the final appearance on this planet of an organism fit to receive spiritual as well as biological life. Both mean essentially the same thing. Both denying the same thing, the doctrine that matter by some blind power inherent in itself has produced spirituality. Or Billy Graham says, I don't think there's any conflict at all between science today and the scriptures. I think that we have misinterpreted the scriptures many times and we tried to make scriptures say things they weren't meant to say. I think that we have made a mistake by thinking the Bible is a scientific book. The Bible is not a book of science. The Bible is a book of redemption, and of course I accept the creation story. I believe that God did create the universe. I believe that God created man, and whether it came by an evolutionary process, at a certain point, he took this person or being and made him a living soul or not, does not change the fact that God did create man. Whichever way God did it makes no difference as to what man is and man's relationship to God. Now, you may disagree with Lewis and Graham. I just want to point out that people of fairly serious Christian faith have looked at these things, have said, well, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that we are created by God and that God has bestowed upon us his image and wants to be in relationship with us. So that's a very short and probably insufficient argument for those of you that are theologically inclined, but I'm not a theologian and I'm talking about science today. I want to briefly talk about evolution and metaphors, because I think a lot of the worries people have about evolution is metaphorical or has to do with language, and one of the biggest problems is this language of random. So when I want to solve a high-dimensional problem in physics or mathematics or engineering, I'll often use a Monte Carlo algorithm. So these are algorithms that use a stochastic generator, a number generator, and then have some kind of thing that acts on that number, some kind of fitness function or some kind of selection function to solve all kinds of high-dimensional problems. We do that regularly because in high-dimensional systems is often the most efficient way of solving an integral. And so it's not at all surprising that if you were to make things that make themselves, if God were to create by that process, then you would expect that process to have this kind of stochastic element. And so you expect there to see in human beings bits of stochastic elements left, even though the design might be very beautiful. It's exactly what you would expect. I think it's probably the best way of making high-dimensional things. The problem is that the word random has all kinds of other connotations in people's minds. It means purposeless. It means meaningless. Nobody says that my Monte Carlo algorithm is a meaningless thing, right? That there's some kind of random meaningless process in it, because its outcome is very well defined. It's what's in fact used, Monte Carlo algorithms are used to price the stock portfolio or the interest of your bank account. So given that that's the case, I wish that we as scientists would stop using the word random mutations and just say stochastic mutations. That would take away all of these, that would take some of the air out of the evolutionism arguments, Dawkinsian arguments about randomness and purposelessness and all the ways that evolution is often taught in school, which I think is noxious and bad. Another important principle is that we often think of evolution as being somehow infinitely malleable, a bit like clay, it can go in almost every single direction. But that's, again, really not quite right. So there are all these genes that are used again and again and again that are like switches. So there's one called PAX6, which is very important for eyes. And this is what happens when you put the human PAX6 gene into the part of the Drosophila fly development process that makes wings. It makes an eye right there on the wing, a compound eye, an ugly eye, but it does. There's a whole series of these genes that they like to give them funny names, Sonic Hedgehog, Shaven Baby, Tin Man. Does anybody idea what Tin Man is linked to? The Wizard of Oz, yes. And what did the Tin Man not have?
Heart.
A heart, exactly. So Tin Man is linked to the heart development. Okay. So this is a Tin Man, it's called Heart. Wizard of Oz is a story. There's a very lovely book by Sean Carroll, a biologist, called Endless Forms, Most Beautiful, New Science of Evo Devo and the Making of the Animal Kingdom. And so one of the things that we've learned is that these kind of genes are much more like Lego blocks. You can put them together, you can rearrange them in different ways and make all kinds of wonderful animals. A lot of the evolutionary changes in body plans are not necessarily by making new proteins, but by rejigging these proteins. You can rewire them in a new way, and you can make something a completely different type of animal. Another interesting kind of question that we looked at briefly is, you know, why are there so few genes, right? So number of genes in humans is not that different from C. elegans, which I think is now close to 21,000. These numbers go up and down a little bit. A little tiny worm, even not that much more than a fruit fly, but clearly we're hugely more complicated. And the reason for that is, as I said before, the fact that these genes interact with each other, that we should think about genes not as blueprints, but as these really fascinating, emergent, interacting systems. And it's really important because there's a lot of gene language used in the popular literature. My genes maybe do it, genetic determinism. A lot of them implicitly have this blueprint metaphor in the background, right? Which is scientifically wrong. And so what people do is they take it's a kind of natural theology. They look at the genes and they try to extract something from it. And here I mentioned to a few of you yesterday Dennis Noble's book on the music of life. And this is just an example of the kind of way these natural theology arguments work. So Richard Dawkins in Selfish Gene said in a famous passage in his always beautiful words, genes swarm in huge colonies, safe inside gigantic lumbering robots, sealed off from the outside world, communicating with it by tortuous indirect routes, manipulating it by remote control. They are in you and me. They create us body and mind. And their preservation is the ultimate rationale for our existence. So there you see a series of essentially natural theological arguments, looking at nature and extracting some kind of meaning and purpose from it. And Dennis, who in fact, interestingly, was one of Richard's thesis examiners, as a very, very, very distinguished Oxford professor of physiology. And Dennis is not a theist. But he said, you know, why don't I just turn this around and do the other way around? He says, genes are trapped in huge colonies, locked inside highly intelligent beings, molded by the outside world, communicating with it by complex processes through which blindly, as if by magic, function emerges. They are in you and me. We are the system that allows their code to be read, and their preservation is totally dependent on the joy that we experience in reproducing ourselves. We are the ultimate rationale for their existence. And Dennis says to me, he asks Richard at some point, can you find an experiment that will adjudicate between our two different views? And of course, there is no experiment. And this is an important point of a broader set of arguments, which is that scientism often is essentially looking at nature and taking a very particular reading of that nature and trying to say, this is who we are and this is how we should live. And the point is, here are two people that probably share quite a bit of ideas and worldview. And yet, they just, when they look at nature, they can extract two very different ways of looking at it. And perhaps neither of those ways are telling us anything about ultimate reasons for our existence. But the point is, the science doesn't tell us one nor the other. And it's really important for those of us that are scientists, that when we speak about science, when we popularize science, that we don't use metaphors wrongly, that we don't do this kind of empirical overreach of our metaphors into all these other areas. Let me give you another example of kind of metaphysical overreach. So one of the other really interesting questions, it's an interesting I guess, an empirical question, what would happen if you were to rerun the tape of life again? And Stephen Jay Gould famously said, wind back the tape of life to the early days of the Burgess Shale, let it play again from an identical starting point, and the chance becomes vanishingly small to anything like human intelligence with grace to replay. In evolution, there is no direction, no progression. Humanity is dethroned from its exalted view of its own importance. This is in his book, Wonderful Life. So what Gould is saying here is, you know, evolution is completely contingent. It kind of wobbles around in different directions. There's no way, you know, it's going to, the reason why it ended up with humans is just completely random chance. Therefore, humans have no purpose. That's, again, a natural theological argument. Christians with a high view of providence might say, who cares if it's a contingent process? God can use contingent processes. He does so all the time in our lives. The Bible has examples of God using what seems like random processes. Ahab was killed by an archer drew his bow and shot at random, it says, and killed Ahab as had been prophesied. So God uses these things. Who cares? So Christians can say, who cares? But it's kind of an interesting scientific question. If he were to ruin the tape of life again, would something like humans grace to replay? If we could somehow, you know, blast this all out of existence and have just all bacteria left and then rerun it again, would something like ourselves appear or not? Well, this book, Wonderful Life, is about the Burgess Shale. It's about a great reinterpretation of the Burgess Shale. And one of the heroes of that book is a man called Simon Conway Morris, a friend of mine, a Christian paleontologist at Cambridge University. In fact, Gould says in his book, there is no Nobel Prize for paleontology, but if there was one, the first would go to Whittington, Briggs, and Conway Morris for the redoing of the Burgess Shale. Now, Simon has a very, very different view on the meaning of his own work than Stephen Jay Gould does. And this is, again, interesting. They're looking at the same work, and their outcomes are very different. Simon says, when you examine the tapestry of evolution, you see the same patterns emerging over and over again. Gould's idea of rerunning the tape of life is not hypothetical. It's happening all around us. And the result is well known to biologists, evolutionary convergence. When convergence is the rule, you can rerun the tape of life as often as you like, and the outcome will be much the same. Convergence means that life is not only predictable at a basic level, it also has a direction. In other words, Simon says, if you were to rerun the tape of life again, something like humans would almost inevitably grace the replay. Now, what does he mean? Well, there's lots of examples of convergent evolution. His book is full of them. One example that, you know, there's lots of examples in its long history of this. Here is something on swimming of a mako shark and a tuna, which, as far as we know, had a very old evolution of divergence. And yet, when you look at their swimming motion, look at the way that it moves, it's incredibly similar. Well, that's not so surprising. They're both solving essentially Navier-Stokes equations through fluid. They're trying to go very quickly. So it's not surprising they could optimize their swimming behavior, and they would converge to similar solutions. But there are other examples, like the saber-toothed cat. So North and South America used to be separated as continents. And interesting, North America had placental mammals like ourselves, but South America only had marsupials, so ones that have their animals in a little pouch like kangaroos do. And so those are independent evolutionary lineages. And what's fascinating is, first of all, how similar some of those animals were. When North and South America came together, basically the placentals came down and more or less overran the marsupials, with the exception of animals like the possum, which went up. And so what's interesting is you find saber-toothed cats in both, placental saber-toothed cats and marsupial saber-toothed cats. And, you know, biologists would say, well, you know, they are quite different. They are different, but they're a pretty remarkable thing, saber-toothed cats. You wouldn't imagine them to evolve more than once. And Simon says, you know, if you're about to be eaten by one, it doesn't really matter whether it's placental or a marsupial. It's going to be the same kind of experience. And so that's an interesting thing. It evolves convergently. Another famous example is the eye. The first order, there are two kinds of eyes in nature, the compound eye and the camera eye. So the compound eye is what flies have, the camera eye is what we have, with a lens and a retina. And what's interesting is that camera eye is shared by a lot of other animals. For example, the octopus has one, there's worms. But if you look in detail at the octopus eye, it's really quite different. So for example, we have our retina with the optical nerve in front of the retina, it has the retina reversed. If you look at the origin of the cells that made the lenses, they're different, right? And as far as you can tell, that the camera eye has independently evolved at least 6 times, 10 times, depending a little bit on how you count. If you need to ask yourself, why did we get a camera eye? And the reason is, if we tried to have the other eye, the compound eye, it would have to look something like this for it to work. Right? So there's an interesting example. You see a very interesting, complicated structure for vision, which evolves again and again and again. Here's another example of convergent evolution, which is really quite striking. These are anteaters. Each of these mammals has a long, sticky, worm-like tongue, no teeth to speak of, and these really sharp claws. And these big, bulging salivary glands, and a stomach as rugged as a cement mixer. And it's a really kind of absurd, long snout that looks kind of like a hot dog, or, you know. And in spite of this, they're going to eat. They have to, because eating ants is a very specialized little niche. You have to have a lot of special properties. But in spite of that, each of these animals has a completely different origin. This one actually lays eggs. Okay, they're completely different in their evolutionary origin, and yet they've all done and converged onto the same thing. So what Simon says in his book is, the principal aim of my book has been to show that the constraints of evolution and the ubiquity of convergence make the emergence of something like ourselves a near inevitability. And Christians could like this or not like this. I think there's many different ways of thinking about it. The important point is that when we look at evolution, the metaphor of it just being kind of who knows where it's going to end up, I think is probably wrong. And so one could describe evolution as a blind, purposeless, and directionless process that tinkers with our infinitely malleable genetic blueprints. By a combination of random chance and survival of the fittest, it stumbles upon contingent organisms best described as secondary phenomena cobbled together by selfish genes. Or, and I've tried to rewrite this a little bit, you could describe evolution as a symphonic interplay between genes, cells, organs, and body that wires a toolkit of Lego-like blocks, Lego block-like components into interacting networks in order to explore a highly structured search space. The inevitable outcome of the stochastic process is the emergent self-endless forms most beautiful that we see around. And the only thing I'm pointing out is that these are two very different ways of looking at the same process. I personally favor the last one. Okay, in the last few minutes, I want to talk about one last question, which is, why do the kinds of impossibility arguments that are often used by opponents of evolution, why have they had so little, why should we maybe think twice about them? So let me give you an example of an impossibility argument that you may be familiar with. So proteins fold into three-dimensional shapes. So this protein, by folding into three-dimensional shape, its particular shape gives it a function. Right? That's a very important part in biology. And one of the interesting paradoxes that Cyrus Leventhal, a famous biophysicist at MIT, pointed out in 1968 is, well, let's say you take a protein made of 150 amino acids. You say there's 10 angles between each one of them, then you have on the order of 10 to the 150 different states modulo some crossing constraints. So how on earth does this unstructured protein find this really structured state? If we were to search at any kind of reasonable speed, like a femtosecond per state, it would still take longer than the age of the universe for it to search through that entire space. And so that seems like a great paradox. How can these things fold? That argument, if I made you that argument, if we only found proteins fully folded, we never found proteins folding, and somebody said to me, you know, I think they used to be disordered, and then they folded into this form, I'd say to you, well, here's an argument, pretty hard argument, it'd take longer than the age of the universe for that to happen, there's absolutely no way that it could happen. It seems like a very reasonable combinatorial argument. This combinatorial explosion of possible configurations, and has to find a very small subset of those. There's just no way. And so, as an impossibility argument, that argument would seem pretty strong. And of course, the fact is we can observe proteins folding in our labs in very, very short amounts of time. And so given that was the case, many hundreds or thousands of scientists spent a long time thinking about how this would work. There's a concerted effort on it. And roughly speaking, the argument is that there was something wrong with the way Leventhal formulated that problem. And the way he formulated it wrong was that he was thinking of this like a golf course. It was a golf course of many, many possibilities. There's one little hole that you've got to find, and you're blindly searching for that golf course. But what if instead of that golf course you had a funnel, a big giant kind of hole in the ground with a hole in the bottom? It doesn't matter where you start, you're always going to roll down into the bottom one. In other words, for proteins to fold, they have to have this funnel-like landscape. You may ask yourself, what fraction of proteins do that? And that's a difficult question because it's a very big space to search through. But experiments suggest that something like 20% of randomly made proteins fold, so they have this folding property. Yesterday when I talked about the virus self-assembly, the way I designed those viruses was using the same folding principles, the energy landscape principles. I designed interactions that would have this folding landscape and therefore be easy to fold, therefore solve this combinatorial explosion. Of course, what you're probably wondering about is, what about the search question, search in evolutionary space? I can make the same argument. It sounds even worse. I've got these proteins. Each of these can be one of 20 amino acids. So if I have 100 residue long protein, each of these can be 20 different ones. I have basically 20 to the power 100 different possible length 100 proteins. If I were to make them, they would weigh more than the mass of the visible universe. Okay? So protein space is not just vast, it's unimaginably vast. And so the question obviously is, how on earth could you ever find a functional protein in this unbelievably big search space? And well, one of the things that we know is that proteins, two identically folded proteins, can have up to 90% sequence dissimilarity. So there's enormous redundancy in this genetic, in this thing. It can change the sequence around, you have the same thing. So that hugely that packs the space down. Jack Szostak, a famous Nobel Prize winner, did some experiments with random length 80 pieces of protein and found that 1 in 10 to the minus 11 could show some kind of ATP binding. Doug Axe gave it what's probably the largest estimate of 1 in 10 to the minus 77. But actually, if you look across the literature, there's a wide range of experimental variation in this prediction of how likely you are to find a protein in, if you wrap random protein, how likely it is to be functional. And of course, in experiments, we see proteins changing all the time from one function to the other, and so it doesn't seem that surprising at all to biologists that that space is in fact fairly richly, densely packed with visible, with viable proteins. But I want to tell you in the last few minutes about a simpler system that I've been working on in my lab, because I've been interested in this search question for quite some time. I think there's clearly an something analogous to the Leventhal paradox, which can be solved. You should be able to solve these kind of combinatorial problems in search space as well. And so here's an RNA. So RNAs are simpler because there's only four different, rather than 20 different units. An A, C, G, and U. And what they also do, one of the ways you can study them is a nice model system, because they form these secondary structures. The secondary structure basically means what sticks to what. Okay, so if I have this particular sequence, U, A, A, C, all the way to G, I can calculate the free energy minimum of that. I can fold it into this particular structure. And this is the free energy minimum for this particular structure at room temperature. And so you can fold this thing. That's interesting. You can fold it. You can write down the phenotype as the shape in this, these kind of particular representations. If I take a length 15 RNA, which is actually incredibly small biologically, there are four different possible bases that you could have at each point. So there's 4 to the power 15, which is a billion sequences. So you might say, well, the chance of finding something in there is 1 in a billion. Okay? It seems like incredibly small. But let's say I want to find one of these shapes. Well, there's only 431 shapes, right? So actually, that's not so hard, because there's this typical redundancy I told you about with the proteins as well. Many, many, many different sequences give you exactly the same shape. And protein space is the same way. It has this enormous redundancy in it. So already, I've gone from 1 in a billion, which seems hard, to 1 in 431, which doesn't seem quite so hard. In fact, this space has all kinds of interesting topological properties, including the fact that you can find from this particular guy almost every single other phenotype in one or two or three steps at the most. Okay, so these spaces are hugely interconnected. We call this something called, it's a property called shape space covering. But now I have 431 different phenotypes. I have a billion different genotypes. Okay, so that billion genotypes maps into 431 phenotypes. How are these distributed? Okay, does each phenotype have roughly the same number of sequences, or is there some kind of bias in these sequences? Well, here's an interesting thing. Here's the length 15 ones, ranked from the most, the one number one, which has the most phenotypes, to number 431, which has the least. You see that they're hugely skewed. Okay, if I go to the next slide, you'll see it again. These, basically the top 25 here, this one has 11 million sequences, this one has 5 million, this one only has 2, this one only has 26. These top take up more than half of the sequence space. So if I were to randomly grab a sequence from this RNA space, I have a 1 in 2 chance of grabbing one of these particular phenotypes. Okay. So that's interesting. The space is highly skewed towards a subset of the possibilities. Right? And in fact, what we've recently been doing is looking at longer RNAs, like length 50, length 60. You can make a prediction based on this theory of what, if you look at nature, if you make some very simple evolutionary arguments, what the distribution of these genotype set sizes would look like. And what you see here in the blue is a natural RNA, and the red is the ones, ones in nature from databases, and red are our theoretical predictions. And there's a pretty remarkably good agreement. And so, in fact, this is a logarithmic scale, so the average that you see in nature is several orders of magnitude larger than the average over the phenotypes. It's just a basic principle that evolution searches in genotype space, not in phenotype space, and by doing so, it heavily biases you towards certain outcomes. In fact, if you think a little bit about the space that this thing has, it's not just a simple two-dimensional space. It's a very highly complicated space. It's high-dimensional spaces. It means, for example, that you can easily get from, that's why you can easily get from any one phenotype to any other phenotype in just 1 or 2 steps. So if you have a length 15 RNA, there's a billion different sequences, but I can go from any sequence to any other sequence in just 15 steps. Right? And that scale, as that scales up, the distance in that space scales logarithmically with the size. So it doesn't matter, even the very, very large RNAs just have hyper-astronomically large numbers of sequences, I can get from anywhere to anywhere else in just a few steps. And so I actually think, I'm writing a paper right now called Against Landscapes, where I think the kind of landscape picture where you have these high peaks with this kind of big valleys in between that you have to go through, I think is a metaphor that doesn't really really work. And so what we see here, and there's been a lot of work on this, there's been a lot of experiments on these what are called CELEX experiments where you put random pieces of RNA together, and there's estimates, this is on the lower end, sometimes it's slightly higher, this is by Rob Knight. There's a lot of work on microbiome, actually, who points out that he thinks that it seems like something on the order of 10 to 12, 10 to 15 RNA molecules, random lengths, is probably enough to contain all chemically plausible or all chemically observed RNA activities. That's an incredibly, that sounds like a lot, but it's a very small number of molecules. That's a zeptomole, okay? That's an incredibly small number. So what I'm pointing out here is just to say, if you want to make the kinds of combinatorial arguments why evolution couldn't possibly work, these are arguments that are attractive to physical scientists because they resemble the types of arguments physical scientists would make. They have almost no traction with my biological colleague who just think, well, whatever, it's just a theoretical argument, right? You just think, whatever. But I think we should be careful about them because I've just shown you 2 examples, one, the Leventhal paradox, one, the search in RNA space, where what seems like a very strong and powerful combinatorial argument, the kind that you often see in the literature by people that doubt evolution, is very vulnerable to certain types of assumptions. And that's where I would like to end. Thank you very much.